Welcome to Barnyard Language, honest talk about running farms and raising families. We are Katie and Arlene, an Iowa sheep farmer and an Ontario dairy farmer, with six kids, two husbands, and a whole lot of chaos between us.
While this is a podcast for farm families, sometimes our content isn't for the whole family. So kick off your boots, reheat your coffee, and join us for some Barnyard Language.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Barnyard Language. It is spring. The birds are singing, and Katie is probably going to tell me that crops are growing or something because we still have nothing in the ground. But tell me what's going on in Iowa, Katie.
Jim was complaining that the rye is growing too well, which...
Hush, Jim.
I understand it's a problem because it's a cover crop, and it needs to be killed before we can plant. And so it growing too efficiently is a bit of an issue because it, I think, increases what we have to do to kill it. But the oats are in and they're growing well. The boy child asked me yesterday if he could plant some oats. He needs his own little field in our front yard, I guess. I'm hoping it doesn't need to be more than like 10 square feet or something. Or like 1 square meter, I think, would be about the same as 10 square feet.
Sure, we'll go with that.
Canadians, whatever, figure it out. The rest of the world can Google. You're fine.
A corner that you're going to have to try and avoid with a lawnmower.
Yes, exactly. I did my bit to support the local greenhouses yesterday. I hope they appreciate it. I'm sure they do. But I filled most of our raised beds up yesterday. I have a few more things to plant and bought a bunch of flowers, and we have a local greenhouse for our...
So it feels like I should ask, what are you growing?
Well, for our local listeners, which is a surprising number, Ben Jagurda's greenhouse in Postville has amazing quality plants, and they have a lot of unusual plants, different perennials and things that, you know, stuff you're never going to find at Walmart, let's put it that way. So what am I not growing at this point might be a better question. But I put in some tomatoes, and yes, I am looking out the window, but the raised beds are right outside the window. The lettuce is up, the peas are up, the onions are in. The one downside of using compost that we compost animals in is that I'm pulling out bones, and Jim informed me that indeed probably making wind chimes out of cattle and raccoon bones was a little creepy even for me.
Is that a line too far for him?
Apparently, yeah. I'm finding a lot of raccoon jawbones in my soil, which is... Raccoons have very pointy teeth, which I didn't... I guess you don't really appreciate that when they're still...
You try not to get too close to their sharp teeth, typically, if they're still alive, I would think.
Yes, yes.
I'm intimidated by raccoons.
I try not to get too close to any parts of live raccoons. I was bitten by someone's pet raccoon as a child, and I've just never quite recovered.
Raccoons are pretty terrifying, and I've never been bit by one.
I mean, I've physically recovered,
yes,
but emotionally, not so much.
There are still scars there.
Yes. All of the, most all of the migratory birds are back. The hummingbirds are back. The orioles, the orchard orioles, and the barn swallows are back, which is nice. I feel like this update is really lacking in anything that's going to be interesting to anyone.
I don't know. I mean, wind chimes made out of raccoon skulls is kind of...
Yeah.
Not where I was expecting it to go.
Valid. Probably not where anybody really expected this to go. Except people who know me. So, sorry, folks. How are things at your house, Arlene?
Oh, things are going okay. Like I said, it's still too wet. We had a couple of dry days. One surprise dry day where they actually were able to work up a little bit of ground, and then it poured rain. So... nothing much happening still on the crop side, but maybe we'll get some dry weather in maybe 2 or 3 days in a row and get some more ground worked up, or maybe some manure spread. I don't know. We'll see. It's still early, I guess. I keep telling myself that. What else has been going on? Well, it's...
I feel like that's one of the most irritating things is when it rains every day, like you can just sort of lean into it. But when it's dry for like 2 hours less than you need it to be dry to be able to do anything, and then it rains, that is some next level fuckery. I'm just gonna... Ugh. I feel you on that one.
Yeah, for sure.
Other question, how many cows came home from college?
So
I believe you were expecting one.
Yes, I was expecting two because there was my daughter's jersey that she's borrowing for this show season. And then we have another 4-H'er who her and her dad and another farmer bought an animal together, but it will be housed at our place. So I was expecting those two. And then there were two others that apparently one was a really good deal. And then the other one he saw in the show ring and just asked a few questions about, and then it also became a really good deal. So then there were, so there's two Holsteins, two jerseys. And, but he also trucked one animal home for someone else. So then he said he paid for the trucking. So that was the justification for some of those purchases. So two that we don't own ourselves, but will be housed here. And then two that we now do own came home from the trip. So it was not from college specifically. She went from, wrote her last exam, moved out of residence, and then went straight to a cow show. And so there was a show and sale associated with the National Holstein Convention, which was held not too far away from where she went to school. So that's kind of how that all came together.
It makes me feel better about what I spend at the greenhouse when I'm let out unchaperoned, to know that at least I didn't come home with more than twice as many cows as was anticipated. Really, I came home with zero live animals, which is good. And since my own husband went to a tractor dealership this weekend, I feel better about it.
Did he come home with anything expensive?
I didn't ask. Sometimes discretion is the better part of valor, Arlene, and not asking is.
Yes, that's true. Yes. So I don't do much growing of things, but I did do my garden center run the other day and mostly bought wood chips to put down on my flower bed so I don't have to pull weeds this summer, and a new apple tree because I had two very healthy apple trees last spring, and then by the end of summer one of them produced 10 apples and then died, so I needed to replace that one with another one so that they could cross-pollinate. So I bought myself an apple tree and a whole bunch of mulch, and that was my early investment. I don't know if I'm going to plant any vegetables this year. For a few years I just haven't, because I don't really want to, and my sister-in-law has a market garden, so then I can kind of justify why would I grow vegetables when I can just go and support my sister-in-law and brother-in-law? So that's what I do for vegetables instead. And it seems to work out for me and them too, I expect.
I will say I'll add some more social media content, but I invested in raised beds this year, had somebody local build them. And it has been a game changer in both the ease of gardening and my enthusiasm about going out and doing it, to not have to like climb around on the ground to do it, and that the soil is already loose. And
yeah, it's a whole different experience.
Yeah, it's my arthritic back and my weird blood pressure situation really appreciate the not climbing up and down, and it's very, very posh.
Yes, for sure. Why don't we go ahead and introduce our guest for this week?
All right, sounds good.
We are talking to Laura Cook, who is joining us from New York State, so not too far away from where I live. And Laura is a listener, so that's exciting for us. So she already knows our first question. And so I'm just going to go ahead and ask, Laura, what are you growing?
I'm so excited to be on the show today. I'm growing a wild 5-year-old boy child who is homeschooled. And my husband and I like to say that we're growing a farm from scratch, because we bought forested land in the Adirondack Park with no improvements, no power, no water, anything like that. And we have built our farm, just the two of us, maybe a little bit of help from my in-laws, but just the two of us for the most part. We built our barn by ourselves, and everything that we have on the property we did. So, we raise goats, pigs, chickens, ducks, turkeys. We do pastured poultry, pasture-raised pork, eggs. And we're leaning into more mixed vegetables now that we have a huge greenhouse. So we're really excited about that.
That is a lot of different things. So can you describe a little bit in terms of scale, just so people have kind of an idea? I mean, I know chicken math is hard, but, you know, in terms of like numbers of livestock or the space that you have cleared and are taking up with what you're doing?
Yeah, so we have, I think, a little over 42 acres. It's kind of in flux at the moment. Not all of that is cleared. A lot of it is forested, and we use a lot of it as silvopasture. We're kind of doing silvopasture by reduction. So we're clearing trees out as we go. We have a small goat herd. Right now we have 17 in the barn, but we've just started our kidding season, so we'll probably be double that in a couple of weeks. And we do a few hundred broiler chickens each year and maybe 50 turkeys. And we process the broilers and the turkeys on farm, but our pigs and our goats go to a USDA facility a couple hours away.
Lauren, in looking at your website, I saw that your son got a couple goats when he was, what, 2?
Yes.
Assuming that he did not drive to the auction himself, being 2, who's to blame for that?
I am. The goats that belong to Ivan they were born on the farm. He just has a couple of Nigerian dwarf cross weathers. We don't actually raise Nigerian dwarfs, so we just had a Nigerian dwarf buck at the time. And these 2 little boys were born, and they were so cute. And I said, oh, well, he can keep them. But they kind of serve a purpose because if you've ever worked with goats, not all of them are friendly, although that's a common misconception. And our goats are mostly horned, so it can get a bit dangerous if people don't know how to, like, read their body language and work with them. So we have a lot of visitors to our farm. We do a lot of agritourism. And so my son's goat are both polled, one was actually born polled and the other, it was disbudded, but they're twins, so riddle that one. But so they're little guys, they're friendly guys, and they don't have horns. So they are kind of mascots for our farm. When people come visit, when we do breakfast on the farm and stuff like that, those are the goats that go out and get to be pet, and the milking goats stay in the barn where they belong. So they can't hurt anyone.
So these were not they weren't the first goats on the farm?
No, no.
Okay. We had a few Nigerian dwarves for a while, and they, yeah, we decided that sheep was a better fit for us, because I said that with the goats, we were just going to, instead of putting up perimeter fencing, I was just going to put like a 12-foot razor wire straight down the middle with like concertina wire and electrified and a moat, and just let them spend all day figuring out how to get back and forth across it. And they probably never noticed that there wasn't anything actually keeping them in.
Yeah, it's always really funny to me when people come to me at the farmer's market and they're like, oh, I really want to get goats. Like, out of all the livestock I have ever worked with, goats are the biggest pain in the ass. I love them, but they're a pain in the ass.
Yeah, no, I would love to have more goats, but they're definitely not a starter animal. I think there's a reason that people start with chickens, or, you know, animals that if they climb on your car are not likely to do tremendous damage like goats can.
You sound like you're speaking from experience there about goats on your car, Katie.
No, absolutely not. But theoretically, if goats climbed on your car.
Theoretically, if goats were on your car. Yeah, for sure.
It's better than a horse on your car, though. I did work at a horse barn when I was a teenager, and one of the horses decided to climb on top of somebody's brand new BMW.
Ooh, wow.
We had a horse at a farm I worked at kicked out somebody's taillights one time, but didn't actually get on top of the car, which I guess. I mean, are we talking like a full-size horse or like a mini horse?
No, this was a full-size horse. She was mean. She was very mean. And she just destroyed somebody's car.
Wow. Hopefully they were a real horse person.
Yeah. The other thing is that meanness in animals varies so much by size. You know, as to how impactful, literally, that meanness can get.
Oh, yeah, I'd rather have a mean Shetland pony than a mean Dutch warm blood.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Okay, Arlene, sorry.
That's all right. In addition to the what are you growing, I was also curious about how and where you're selling all the things that you're growing, or what you're doing with your stuff.
We market everything direct to consumer. we make goat's milk soaps and other goat's milk products. So we sell those through our website, but we also sell meat and, well, pretty much everything that we grow is sold through our website. We do like a local pickup option, and we're going to be rolling out local delivery really soon. We also sell at the farmer's market, and we have a farm stand on our farm, which is awesome. It's grown every year. More people find out about us. And still, I think we've been doing it since 2020. And there are still people that come and they're like, oh, I've never heard of this before. This is so great. And it's just really nice to like see the same people come back over and over again.
That's nice. Now, when it comes to a farm stand, people have kind of different setups. Do you have a farm stand that you always have someone manning? Is it an honor system, or how do you make sure that you are, you know, using your time efficiently, but also making sure that people don't take off with more than they paid for or things that they didn't pay for at all?
Fortunately, our experience has been that most people are really trustworthy in our area. And that's something that baffles tourists when they come, because we've had people come from like Miami or like Southern California, and they're like, how do you put stuff out by the side of the road and nobody steals it? So we're really fortunate. We have just a great customer base and generally great neighbors. So nobody absconds with our products, but we do have a camera in the farm stand after we had some issues with somebody who moved into town. So that person isn't coming around anymore though, now that they know we can see them.
Yeah,
I feel a little weird because I actually put a security camera on our driveway a few weeks ago, simply because I work from home, but with my computer set up, I can't see who's here. So the dogs will tell me if somebody comes, but they won't tell me who it is, you know. But now it feels really like maybe I need to put something over the camera just so people don't know there's a camera, because it seems weird that there's a camera just like in the driveway, like, I can watch you. And I'm trying really hard to not abuse the feature where you can talk to people through the camera. Although, maybe I should put like a garden gnome or something on top of it and then just go ahead and talk to people from it. And it'll just be like,
I like that.
That could really, yeah, really scare the UPS driver. We'll probably never get any packages ever again.
So Laura, you said that you and your husband are building your farm from the ground up. So what is your background when it comes to agriculture? How did you become a farmer?
Yeah, so I'm not from a farm family. I'm a first generation farmer. And I came out of high school with pretty much zero understanding of the food system. I was actually a vegetarian when I graduated from high school. And now I raise meat because I couldn't tell you who said it, but be the change you want to see. So I wanted to be involved in the industry and do the right thing from the inside, as if you will. So, but yeah, I graduated high school without understanding where my food was coming from, which is alarming looking back on it. And I didn't realize that I could have a career in agriculture because nobody had ever presented that to me as an option. So I was in college studying business, and I just wasn't happy. And I was talking to a friend from back home who grew up showing in 4-H and worked on a dairy farm. And she said, well, you just need to meet people that are like me. So you need to go to the College of Agriculture. You need to sign up for the clubs. You need to change your major, and you're going to be fine. And she was totally right. Shout out to Katie for course correcting my life and making me become a farmer. And so I joined the dairy science club at my school, and I started showing heifers, and I just fell in love and decided that that's what I wanted to do. So I ended up in Vermont working in the dairy industry over there. And then I met my husband, moved to New York, and we started our own farm. And somewhere along the way, I got 2 degrees in agriculture. I just finished my master's degree in December. So it's I found my calling. But the really cool thing for me is that I'm adopted, and I decided to connect with my biological family when I was 23 after my son was born. And I've gotten to know them and have a really good relationship with them now, but I found out that I have dairy farming on both sides of my family. And my grandfather actually worked for the AI company that I interned for way back in the day. So just the it was kind of fate, I suppose, that I would end up doing what I do.
That's really interesting. Yeah, that the you do actually have a, you know, a biological link to what you ended up doing. So are you someone who has converted your husband to a farmer, or did you meet through farming circles? What's his kind of ag story?
He's a first generation farmer as well, and probably a bit unwilling. It's totally my fault. Whenever animals get out or have some sort of problem in the middle of the night, they're my animals to go deal with. I mean, he's very helpful, but, you know, I dragged him into this life. But he was a mechanic when we met, and he's still very mechanically inclined. So we kind of have different skill sets that we've brought into our business. So he does a lot of construction and maintenance and stuff like that, where I'm doing more of the like herd health work and marketing and that kind of stuff. But we work as a team in everything, and it's really great most of the time.
I have to say, as someone, I mean, my husband grew up on a farm. Our kids are fifth generation on this property, but he's a tractor guy. He's mechanical like that. And I'm much more into the livestock. I think he's getting a lot more into the livestock, but in a lot of ways, it can be very nice to have those separate skill sets and interests, because you're not quite as up in each other's business about things. Like, obviously, I know that we have row crops. I can identify them. I know something about them. That's all I need to know about it. Like, that's his baby. I don't argue with him about decisions. He'll ask my opinion, and I'm like, I'll give an opinion, I guess. Don't listen to it, but
it's not based on any knowledge.
Yeah, like, you can bounce stuff off me. You know, but it's kind of nice not to have that pushback. Like, both of us know enough about the other side to have some thoughts, but neither of us is like, do it my way about stuff, you know, or just like, tractors, do it. Just go to town on that.
And then if it breaks, it's his tractor, right?
Yeah, it's the same way that it's your son when they won't go to bed. Your child, your cows.
Yeah, or Laura's goat when it goes through the fence. Yeah.
Exactly.
So I know another thing that you're working on is community composting and diverting waste. Can you tell us about that program and what you're doing and why it's important to you?
Yeah, absolutely. So we started our farm's community composting program in 2022, kind of on a whim. We got a small amount of grant funding to purchase buckets to distribute to people so that they could put their food scraps in the buckets and then bring them back to the farm. We've since done away with the bucket swap program, and we have like a big collection bin down by our farm stand. And when we roll out our local delivery in a few weeks, we will actually also be rolling out a residential compost pickup program. So we'll go around to people's houses and pick up their food scraps. But we started composting our household's food scraps not too far before that. We'd always composted the manure from our animals and didn't make the connection that we could throw food scraps in that pile too. So we started composting our household's food waste and then just broadened it to the community. And now that's something that's really central to what we do. So there are a bunch of economic and environmental reasons to compost. When food is wasted and it goes into the landfill, it breaks down anaerobically, so without any oxygen, and it produces methane when it does that. But if it's composted, that's an aerobic process, so there's no methane generation. Obviously, methane is a concern, greenhouse gas, not great. but also, the food system is kind of meant to be circular. So when food waste is going into a landfill, the nutrients aren't being recovered and they're not being returned to where the food is grown, and they're basically just gone forever. And that's a resource that, I mean, you have to buy fertilizer, or you have to buy compost from somebody who's making it. So that input is it's of significance in agriculture, and it's worth capturing for sure.
I think too, I really enjoy, we do compost manure, and I'm wondering, do you guys do any animal composting as well when you?
Yep. So any mortalities that occur on our farm go into the compost pile. And I know that we have a really good compost pile because we can disappear an entire goat in about 3 days. Obviously, I don't want to put a goat into the compost pile, but when we have an older doe or maybe, you know, some things happen to animals. So when a goat dies, it goes into a pile and it's gone in 3 days, which is awesome. We have a super hot compost pile. Also, we put all of our processing waste into the compost pile. So when we do chickens and turkeys on the farm, all of the guts and feet and stuff like that end up in the pile too, and they're gone really quickly.
And do you have a farm dog, or is your, how do you keep your dog out? Or is your pile hot enough that the dog just doesn't get a chance to really?
So we have three dogs. Two are livestock guardian dogs. They are in the fence with the goats, so they can't access where our pile is. And then our third dog is an ancient little pit bull who will, pit bulls have very little hair and they don't love being outside, at least not in my experience. So she'll come down the steps, go to the bathroom, do her business, sniff around a little while, and then go right back into the house. So she's never over by the pile. Actually, the biggest issue we have right now is our ducks are always in the pile, like rooting around looking for something. And it's just so nasty to me that they'll be in there with all the processing waste from their fellow poultry and they're trying to eat it. So they are getting put in a fence this year, a very big fence, but they are going to be fenced out of the compost and also out of the road because I'm sick of seeing them stop traffic. It's one of these days, it's not going to work out well for them.
They're going to end up in the compost pile for another reason.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad I'm not the only one who has watched traffic just stop in the middle of the road, because especially, you know, we have Muscovies, and for anyone who's never seen a Muscovy duck, they have zero fucks to give. They will not move just because there's a car. They're just like, you can go around me, and then it'll just stand. So, yeah. We also compost livestock, but we have a lab cross and an Australian shepherd. And thankfully, they never go for anything that's real, like, fresh. They'll find, you know, a leg bone with a deer hoof still on it or something and drag that around the yard for a week until it's real gross, or, you know, something that's flattened or whatever, which I guess is less gross than them dragging out, like, a whole something. But, yeah. So my other question was if you have suggestions about how to contain different size piles, because as a chicken owner myself, I've given up on having a pile anywhere that the chickens can see because it just spreads. So now I just pretty much throw everything to the chickens and, you know, dump it along the fence line and go for it and don't try to pile because it doesn't stay there anyway.
Yeah, so kind of depends on just how much volume you're dealing with. A lot of people just use pallets to set up a compost area, and I think that works fairly well. But for us, because we have very significant volume, we have a concrete pad, and then they call them mafia blocks. They're like those really big, like 6 foot by 4 foot by, I don't really know the dimensions, but they're huge concrete blocks stacked up on three sides of our main composting area. And then after the compost has gone through its primary phase, we move it out into a field, and it's just out there, and I don't care if the chickens get into it because it's gone through the primary like heat kill step, so it's not a concern anymore.
Our goal as podcasters is to create a program that makes you feel less alone as a farming, ranching, or homesteading parent. But we can't do it alone.
Supporting Barnyard Language on Patreon helps us cover production costs and ensures the future of the show, but you'll also gain access to exclusive perks and behind-the-scenes content.
Your support enables us to continue bringing you the thought-provoking conversations and inspiring stories week after week. So if you find value in what we're doing and want to be part of the Barnyard community, head over to patreon.com/barnyardlanguage and choose a tier that suits you.
I did forget to mention that I'm doing some work right now with an organization called Compost for Good in partnership with Clarkson University. So I'm orchestrating a community outreach program to educate people in my area about food waste diversion, why it's necessary, and how it can be done.
So that leads really well into my next question, because I was wondering about, you know, if other farmers or small businesses are looking at getting into composting or starting up a program in their communities or for their communities, what kind of investment, I mean, you talked a little bit about the physical space, but what kind of investments in terms of time and education and infrastructure and that, you know, getting that community buy-in, does it take to really get started?
I would say it depends what kind of a farm you are as to how much you're going to need to invest. I find that livestock farms, unless they have like enough volume of manure to have a lagoon, and then they're not necessarily composting it in a way that, you know, you can add to. But you can add food scraps to any other like bed pack of any species and make really good compost with some additions. You have to add some carbon material in certain cases. For us, we have a lot of waste hay, so it kind of balances the level of food scraps and the level of manure that are going into the pile. We don't have to add a lot, but you do have to add, certain people have to add like wood pellets or wood shavings or something else to balance the recipe. But that being said, the biggest hurdle I think is education, because it's just going to be a stinky, disgusting, vermin attracting mess if you're not doing it right. And there's a lot of different ways to do it right. So depending on what you have for resources and equipment and the size, there's a lot of different ways you can approach it. But to do so, you want to know what you're doing before you just start piling stuff up. We didn't have any clue what we were doing. We were just piling stuff. But if you have a plan, it's going to go a lot better, hopefully. So the Institute for Local Self-Reliance has a lot of really good resources for farmers that are looking to get into composting. And my experience has been that with our community composting program, we're kind of bringing things full circle. People are buying stuff from our farm, they're eating it, and then the waste is coming back to us and being used to make more food. I love that thinking. I think that community composting makes a lot of sense for farmers like myself who are direct marketing their products, because it's a way to maintain that relationship with the customer and bring it to a deeper level.
Yeah. Now I'm thinking about our local climate, because we don't live too far apart. How does composting differ in the winter and the summer? Because you could have a fairly frozen pile of compost at some times of year and a really hot, stinky mess, like you talked about in other months of the year.
A lot of composting in the winter in northern climates has to do with volume and your recipe. So if you have a properly balanced recipe and enough mass to keep the pile hot, you're not going to have that many issues. That's where home composting is a real challenge in our area, because people aren't producing enough to keep the pile going in the winter, and so they're not reaching the temperatures. You need to be holding compost at a minimum of 131 degrees for, I believe, 3 days to make it safe for use, and so we're able to achieve that because we have a lot of volume. So even when it's like negative 20 degrees, our pile is still cooking right away. And then in the summer, the challenge is just getting really dry, or the spring it's too wet because we don't have a covered pile, so that's kind of the seasonal challenges.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
So I'm wondering, because I know that my husband, who does religiously listen to the show, hi dear, is gonna want to know, if your husband's a mechanical guy, I'm assuming that part of the big draw for composting for him is getting to turn all that shit over with the tractor, which is deeply satisfying, don't get me wrong. And it sounds like you definitely have a pile big enough that we're not talking pitchfork situation, which is much less satisfying. What is he using to turn it over? Inquiring minds need to know.
Yeah, we have a smaller tractor because we're a smaller farm, and that's what we could afford when we were starting out. So I think our tractor is 26 horse Mahindra, and we've found that pallet forks are the most effective way to turn the pile. If you try to scoop it with the bucket, it's kind of like just a clump. But if you try to go into it with the pallet forks, it breaks it up and it kind of turns itself over. It's really satisfying to watch. My husband does most of that because he's a better operator than I am. I mean, I can, but I think he does. You're right. It's very satisfying to see the steam coming off the pile and everything when he's turning it. But there are bigger windrow turners and stuff like that. And that's probably the direction we're headed as we scale up. We'd like to get probably a skid steer at some point and then a bigger tractor and a windrow turner for our secondary phase compost.
Well, that's good to know, though, because I think my husband is using a bucket. So maybe I'll have to suggest that to him. Also, you said you have hogs as well. Is that correct? Or you have raised hogs? Have you done any deep bedding with them? We found it didn't work as well with the sheep because their output is very different than a hog's is. But I know, you know, we're in northern Iowa, so our climate is also relatively similar to yours. And, you know, for anyone who's not familiar with deep bedding, you basically compost in place and just keep adding dry bedding on top. And we found a lot of times it was substantially warmer in the barn in the winter than it was outside just from the heat from the compost. And, you know, you would go in the morning and the bedding would be steaming just from the compost action, which obviously keeps the pigs a lot toastier. So I'm wondering if you guys have done any exploration with that or what your thoughts might be.
I haven't really thought about it like that before. We do deep bed our pigs in the winter, but at least for the previous years, this may be changing in the future, but our pigs are actually outside all winter. They have little like pallet houses, and they're deep bedded in those, but I don't hang out in those. So I've never really observed like the heat of the deep bedding. And we don't deep bed in our goat barn in the winter because it's impossible in the spring to like get through feet and feet and feet of disgusting wet hay. And it's not a good, we've tried it. We have not enjoyed it. So we keep the goat barn scraped even in the winter.
Yeah, we're very fortunate that our barn, now that we have a skid steer, you can pull the dividers out and just scoop it all up. Because yes, when we were scooping it by hand, it was a very different situation. But yeah, I know when we had hogs, you'd go out in the mornings and you wouldn't even see the pigs because they would get down under, you know, between the composty layer and the dry layer. And you'd just see a little like steam from their nose and you'd, you know, watch them dig out and there'd be steam coming off the bed pack. And it's nice. And it's nice to not feel like we're throwing money away. And I do feel like that's one of the big things for on-farm compost is that if you haul all your shit off and then pay for fertilizer, you're throwing away money and then paying more money instead of, you know, it is obviously more work and more management, but you're not paying for something that you just threw away.
Absolutely. That makes a lot of sense. And we try to buy, well, we don't end up needing to buy very much fertilizer. We do fertilize. We have some leased blueberry field nearby, and we buy fertilizer for that, organic fertilizer, but just because it's not super feasible for us to get the compost there. But in the future, when we have blueberries on our main farm, we'll probably fertilize them with our compost. But I mean, it just depends. You know, you have to look at what the plants need and if that compost can supply what they need or if you would be better off buying a fertilizer for that particular scenario.
Yeah, especially for a specialty crop like blueberries.
Arlene, I have one more compost question and then we can move on.
Sure, go for it.
Has the compost, the, you know, quote unquote regular composting, become a dangerous gateway drug into things like compost tea or, I don't even know what it's called, when you compost animal parts to basically grow maggots to feed your chickens? Which is really cool, but also, like, Maggots.
No maggots here. I don't want them. I know exactly what you're talking about. And we do feed black soldier fly larvae to our chicken because it's really high in calcium. But I do not produce that. Maybe it's something I would look into in the future, but I'm probably not going to want to raise maggots myself.
Not if you can help it, for sure.
The only thing with composting is it just gets bigger because we've realized kind of what our capacity is, and now we want to fill that capacity so we can do more within our community. And we're potentially going to start taking compost from like a local summer camp or one of the local schools. So it just keeps getting bigger, and then you have to find more space to put the compost while it's curing because it takes a while to cure. So yeah, that's the only gateway for us anyway.
Compost math is the same as chicken math, isn't it? Yeah, I get it. We do. I think I've mentioned on this show before, we have neighbors who hunt our property. And in the winter, I'll hang a deer frame, you know, the bones and little scrappy bits up for our chickens in their coop. And they sure make much nicer eggs in the winter. But the minute it gets warm, you got to get rid of it because it's rank real fast. But poultry are omnivorous for sure. So.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, Arlene, now we can move on from rotting stuff.
Now I do have one more compost question. So at this point, are you using all of the compost for your own needs, or can people from the community buy some or come and grab a bag full for their own gardens? Like if they're bringing you their scraps, do that you have a program where other people can come and grab some as well?
Yeah, so we are going to implement a program like that. We'll probably sell buckets of compost or compost by the yard in the future, but we are still scaling up at this point with our community composting program. And we also built a massive greenhouse last year, and we'll be growing everything in the ground in there. So we need to build up the soil in there, and we're using it all right now. But within the next couple of years, I can definitely see us sharing our compost with the community.
So we'll transition from compost into parenthood. I'm not sure what the tie-in is, but I mean, we know that that's what the podcast is about.
Poop.
Poop. There you go. Yeah.
Lots of poop, Arlene. That's the common denominator.
So we often ask people about, you know, kind of to start into this section about the transition into parenthood. So are you willing to talk about kind of the early days? You said your child is 5 now, but thinking back to your first days and weeks and months as a new mom, what was your transition to being a parent like?
I got really lucky. Both my husband and I were not working off the farm at the time that our son was born. And our farm was a lot smaller than it is now. We were just kind of getting started. So we were both around, and to have his help and the help of my in-laws who live close by and my parents coming up from out of state, was really fantastic. And we also got lucky in that we had an easy baby. He was a good eater, a good sleeper. He's a lot more challenging now that he can talk, but he was easy. The challenge for me was that I ended up having to have 2 surgeries in about a month's time because my son was born via C-section, which is obviously a major surgery. And I was in the hospital for like 2-3 days for that, which was totally fine. But I did not know that pregnancy can sometimes induce gallbladder failure or cause gallbladder complication. So about a month after my son was born, I was back in the hospital for 5 days and then out of the hospital for a week and then back in the hospital for 3 more days to have my gallbladder removed because I was just a miserable wreck. But after all that got resolved, things were pretty smooth sailing for a while until my son started talking.
It's a good stretch of time then.
Yeah.
Well, I guess it depends how early they start talking. So you mentioned earlier that you just recently got your master's, right?
Yes.
And that both you and your husband are you both working full-time on the farm?
I'm here full-time. My husband is on... I like to consider him full-time as well because we both put in well over 40 hours a week on the farm. He also works 3 days a week in town. So we're both here, but he's off the farm a little bit
Sure, yeah, he has some off-farm income.
I do some off-farm things as well, although I'm really fortunate I get to do almost all of them remote. So I mentioned before that I'm currently working for Compost for Good and Clarkson University doing this community outreach program. I also do some grant review for SARE, Northeast SARE, and I have a bookkeeping client who's a friend of mine and another farmer. I love doing that because I get to work on somebody else's farm for a day or two, and it's fun. And then I mentor another farmer through the Food Animal Concerns Trust mentorship program. So I stay busy too off the farm, but we're both kind of here full time, and we're both involved in homeschooling.
Sure. So how does that look kind of on a day-to-day or a weekly basis in terms of how you manage all of your priorities and mixing homeschool in there too and childcare and all of those other things and the farm?
It's a lot of chaos, but we do try to keep it under control. So we have a family meeting every Sunday, which I've heard of other farms doing when it's like several different generations or like uncles and cousins and a larger family. And that makes a lot of sense. And so I kind of took that idea and ran with it. And even though we're only a 3-person family, we have a family meeting every week. So we go over what are the priorities for this week? What are we trying to accomplish? What are our schedules looking like? And just try to start the week off being organized. And by the end of the week, it's like, okay, we're in survival mode. We're going to eat whatever leftovers are in the refrigerator. But it starts off having a plan, so that helps.
Yeah, I hear you on that.
I think it's nice to, you know, on Sunday afternoons I try to clean house and like write a menu plan and the whole thing, and it's nice to start the week with that delusional energy that this is going to be the week that you get to Saturday without it being a shit show. Because every week I'm like, yes, this is the week that we'll make it to at least Wednesday before the wheels fall off. And I mean, we never do, but it's nice to get that reset at some point, you know, to kind of pretend like you know what's going on.
Yeah, the eternal optimism of Sunday afternoon.
That sounds like a good movie. I would watch that.
Yeah, that's right. So homeschooling, what led you and your family to that decision, and how does that fit into farm life for you guys?
We have so many reasons for homeschooling, but what I always go back to is my experience in school. And I was bored for most of my journey in school because I was fairly advanced for my age and just not doing anything that kept me engaged. But I also left school with a lack of the practical knowledge that I needed to get by in the world, including understanding of the food system. And so I just wanted to give my son what I didn't. And I went to college not knowing how to do laundry, which shame on me. But I stood in the basement of my dorm building with my quarters trying to figure out how to use the washing machine. And so I wanted to make sure that never happened to him. So he does laundry now on his own, even though he's 5. But he's got the practice.
First homeschool lesson.
Yeah.
I wonder, one thing I've noticed, because my kids, one of them is turning 6 tomorrow and one of them is 7. So we're right in that same stage. When you homeschool, are there still things that you didn't know he had learned that you are just shocked by his progress? Because apparently my kids can read. Both of them can. And I'm like, I know they've been working on reading, obviously. They're in kindergarten and first grade. We read every night. Like, I knew this was a thing, but it feels like with a lot of childhood development, like they don't learn to walk all at once. Like they try and they fall and they try and they fall. And it might take like, I don't know, our son took a ridiculously long time because he had better shit to do. You know, like he was on the floor, he was playing with tractors. Cool. He needs to be on the floor anyway. But this, like, when you send them off to school, they just learn stuff. And then they come home and surprise you with it. I'm wondering if that still happens when you homeschool.
It totally still happens. He surprises me all the time. He comes back from grandma's house and he has this new thing he learned how to do. Or he tags along with us for a lot of what we do on the farm. unless it's dangerous, he's generally there. Like if I'm going to a meeting with the county extension agent, he's there. Or if the farm service agency is coming to the farm, he's there. So he's kind of sitting in on a lot of this adult stuff. And I'm always just surprised by how much he gets out of it. Like he considers himself a composting expert because of the number of technical advisors we've had out to the farm to help us develop our community composting program. And he actually wanted to be on the show today. He thought he was going to be a guest as well.
Is he there?
No, I sent him away.
Otherwise, he would be on the show today.
Yes, and I sent him away because he was so excited to be a guest. And then he said, I'm going to tell them all of the things that you do wrong.
We need this episode. This is the content this show needs.
Now we're going to invite him.
The episode where all of our kids come on and tell us about everything we're doing wrong.
Yeah.
Can you imagine?
I love that. And is it just related to composting or everything?
I told him I was going to talk to you guys about community composting. So that's what he was thinking about. But I'm sure he could find a lot of other things that I'm doing wrong.
That is so fun. So what is your favorite thing about raising your son on the farm?
I just feel like farming and homeschooling kind of go hand in hand because we're surrounded by science. It's so easy to teach biology and business math and like public speaking, customer service. He has a lot of skills that I didn't have at his age and that other kids his age don't necessarily get to develop until later. So it's just great to have him with us, although it does make us work a bit slower and there's more arguing than maybe I would like to have in a typical day.
Well, because you're doing it wrong.
Yeah.
Mom.
That's right. Yep.
Yeah, someone else's opinion.
The more independent he gets, the more, yeah. He thinks, like, he's in charge of the baby goats right now. We just started kidding. And he's out there with the baby goat. And he's saying, well, we need to change this one's name. And this one didn't finish its bottle. And so, you know, he's got it all figured out at 5. Good for him.
I have to say though, having opinionated kids is a pain in the ass, but I'm really proud of the stuff that you're doing and that you're empowering him to have an opinion and to be taken seriously and that you're involving him in these business meetings and that, because I feel like so often, and it's hard to take kids to meetings and it's hard to listen to their opinions sometimes because you're just like, I am an adult. You have a master's degree in this. Like, I'm sure listening to your 5-year-old's opinion about how to do everything is a little like, child. But at the same time, so often, you know, farm kids are raised more like hired help as far as what their real involvement is. And then they maybe go to college or they do whatever, and hopefully they come back. And then we're like, yay, you run the business now. You're making all the decisions. Or, you know, God forbid, the parents don't turn it over and then the kid is 50 and...
and still treated like the hired help.
Yeah. And then they're a grown adult, maybe with kids of their own, and now they're being left in charge of something that they've never run. And that's horrible. That is really deeply unfair. And I'm really, really glad to see that you're involving your kid in all of that stuff, even when it's a pain in the ass, because I'm sure it would be easier for you to do his laundry, you know? But that's not how you raise a competent, independent human. And if you need me, I'll be thinking about all the shit I should be letting my kids do. So, second question, how do you... I don't want to say you put any thought into, have you designed any sort of life skills curriculum for things like laundry and dealing with humans? Or is it just kind of a, I'm not going to wash your clothes if you're going to get this dirty sort of a situation?
Oh no, we're totally winging it. There's not much of a plan. And I help him, like, we all do the laundry together, you know, that kind of a thing. But yeah, we're winging most of it right now. I'm just starting to plan for, he starts kindergarten. So for homeschooled kids in New York, the school year starts like July 1st. So in July, he'll technically be a kindergartner. So I'm just starting to put together a plan. Preschool, we kind of just wung it and hoped for the best and tried to teach him how to write and read. And he's coming along and sprinkle in a little bit of Spanish and life skills. But we're going to have a more concrete plan for kindergarten, although it's the same thing with planning for the week. Like, the best intentions at the beginning and then just hoping it doesn't all go to shit towards the end.
That sounds like a good plan, honestly.
In all fairness, I feel like, and I love my kids' school. I do. I have an immense, immense amount of respect for teachers. But we're at the middle of April, and it feels roughly like it's the Thursday afternoon of their week, as far as the school year goes, that, you know, September is kind of like the Sunday afternoon, and mid-April is kind of like the Thursday afternoon, where you're just like, shit, as long as we all are still alive by the second week of June, fine, good enough. You know, feels like the same.
I'm sure the teachers feel the same way. My mom's a teacher, and I think at this time of the year, she's like, okay, it's almost summer, we can do this. So I'm sure they feel the same way we do.
Yeah, some of those lesson plans are a little less shiny than they were in September. So we've been talking about some of the challenges, but what do you find your biggest parenting challenge these days?
Raising a strong-willed child is a test of my patience and my integrity, and it's a test of everything. And I know that being strong-willed and independent and speaking his mind is going to take him really far in life, but it's hard to deal with every single day. It might be easier maybe if he was going to school and I got a break from him and from arguing every once in a while, but that's only certain days of the week that he goes over to grandma's house or goes to karate or something like that. So yeah, it's just, you know, being patient, I guess, is the biggest challenge.
Katie and I are both doing a lot of head nodding here.
Yeah, I feel like our collective children missed the memo that when we raised them to be strong and independent and critical thinkers, we didn't mean with us. You know, when I said question authority, I didn't mean my authority. I meant like the man, you know, question the man, not your mommy. Like, I mean, they'll probably all be like Supreme Court judges or Nobel Prize winners or whatever, because they're all asking the questions and doing the hard work. But I didn't mean about why is there bedtime and why do you have to go to school and why can't you play Xbox until 11 o'clock at night? And why are popsicles not a breakfast food? You know,
yeah. So many questions.
So many questions.
So what is a piece of parenting advice that you have either learned through your experiences that someone else has shared with you that you kind of hold on to or that you would want to share with other people?
All of that being said about strong-willed children, the one I keep repeating to myself is pick your battles. I feel like everybody says that, but it's really, really true. If he wants to wear Crocs outside in the snow, I'm not going to argue about that. He can figure out that his feet are getting cold and he can come in and change into boots. It's not worth my time to tell him he can't do it and explain why. So, you know, just picking your battles. And then the other thing that I've kind of learned from experience, you know how they say, like, if an airplane is crashing, you're supposed to put on your own mask and get your oxygen before you put on your kid's mask? That's kind of how I feel about self-care. And I just feel like I can't be a good mom if I'm not taking care of myself. And so I've recently, like within the past 2 years, kind of prioritized myself. And I try to take a walk every day. I do yoga every morning when I wake up and just try to focus on what I enjoy and what makes me feel good, because I feel like I can be a better role model to him, to teach him to to seek those things out in his own life, rather than just trying to put him first all the time and burn myself out, and then nobody's happy.
That's a really good reminder that we all, we do all need to be doing that. And like you said, that's modeling for them, right? That we don't want to teach our kids to be martyrs either. So by martyring ourselves, that doesn't benefit us or them in the short or long term. So what are some of the future goals that you and your family, since I know your son is already a farmer, have for the farm going forward?
We're a relatively new business. We've been farming since 2017, but not really at a huge scale until we'll never be at a huge scale. You know, we're a very small farm, but we kind of reached the level where we're at within the past 2 years. So we'd like to continue to grow sustainably and reach a level of profitability that allows both of us to be on the farm full time and not have to work off the farm. That would be ideal. And then to continue to grow and reach a level of profitability that allows our son to come into the business if that's what he chooses to do in the future. And if he decides he wants to have a family, to be able to support his family off of the farm he's not bound to being a farmer by any means, but it's really cute when you ask him what he wants to be when he grows up. You kind of have to. He's not a kid that will tell you right away. Like, you have to list off a couple choices. Like, oh, do you want to be a firefighter? And he's like, yeah. And, oh, do you want to be a truck driver? He's like, yeah. But then you say, oh, do you want to be a farmer? He says, I already am, really confidently. And I love that about him. So I'm not going to hold him to that. He's 5. A lot can change between now and adulthood. But if he does decide to come into the farm, we've already done all the planning to make that happen. And we just need to, you know, like, make enough money to actually support all of us.
That's really cool, too, because in the big picture, if he wants to do something else when he grows up, he's already been a farmer. So, you know, like, that could be his second career, or third career can be other things. But yeah. He's a farmer now. So what he does when he grows up might be something different or might be the same. But yeah, there's choices out there.
I always think that his resume is going to be really impressive if he does decide he wants to, like, look for work off the farm when he's older, because he can literally put pretty much since his birth that he's had a job. So that's the kind of work experience companies are expecting out of entry-level workers nowadays anyway. So
yeah, that's right. What were you doing in preschool? Doing laundry and feeding goats.
Yep, collecting eggs, all that stuff.
Yeah, that's right.
So I think this might actually be the first question in our outline that I've actually asked as it's in here. We ask all of our guests, if you were going to dominate a category at the county fair, what would it be?
So I'm a decent baker, but I'm not going to say baking. I'm going to say making things sourdough that you wouldn't expect to be sourdough. I make sourdough bread a couple times a week. And when you're making sourdough bread, there's something called sourdough discard. So you have to feed the sourdough starter with a mixture of flour and water. And then, you actually have to discard it before you feed it. But anyway, so the discard can be used, but you can also compost it or throw it away if you're a sad person who doesn't have.
We won't even talk about that. It's too sad to think about.
But anyway, I hate food waste, so I hate wasting my sourdough discard. So I make everything sourdough, like pizza crust, waffles, carrot cake, brownies, like everything in my house has sourdough in it. And that would be my county fair contest that I could win, is making things sourdough.
Nice. I like it.
Do you ever, and this might just say a lot about who I am, I mean, I know that sourdough is alive because it has little microorganism-y things. Compost is alive, same reason. Do you ever have a vague fear in the back of your mind, even when you, if you were going in some bizarro world situation, you were going to just dump that discard in a trash can, how concerned would you be that it will become sentient and like kill you in your sleep. And or kombucha SCOBY and or microorganisms from your compost and or soldier fly larvae, what have you. It's just me. I can see by your faces, this is just me.
No, I have never thought about that, but I feel like that's going to be my nightmare tonight. So
I know I've heard this, and God, I hope it's an urban legend, about people whose septic tanks have been taken over by kombucha SCOBYs, because a septic tank is basically how many hundred gallons of food for bacteria and yeasty things. And for anyone who doesn't make kombucha, a SCOBY is the goobery microorganism mass that's, it's like a gelatinous brain sort of a thing. And it feels like a real, like, alligators in the sewer situation. But I've heard from fairly reputable sources that if you dump too much of it in your septic, you can end up with some real problems. So, now that everybody's going to have nightmares about SCOBYs and...
Yikes. Good to know. Put it in the compost.
I'm going to have to read about that. I'm really intrigued, but very concerned as well.
Yeah.
Now, anyone who listens to the show knows why it's hard for me to write a script, because you never know what questions Katie's going to ask or what weird factoid she's going to come up with. But that's what makes it interesting.
It's weird that my children are so challenging and full of strange questions, Arlene. I don't know where they get it from.
Yeah, where would they possibly get that from? On that note, we'll move into our cussing and discussing and see what else Katie has to come up with. So if you are a listener, you can send in your cussing and discussing on our SpeakPipe or to our email. So go to speakpipe.com/barnyardlanguage for a voice memo, or barnyardlanguage@gmail.com if you want us to read it out for you, or you can send a voice memo there too. Katie, what are you cussing and or discussing this week, other than dreams of scary living things?
How hard it is to buy pants, especially after your... I feel like my body shape changed quite a bit when I had kids. But it's really hard to find pants where, like, the hips fit right, the thighs fit right, the lower legs fit right. Like, where everything fits the way you want it to fit, especially jeans. And then if, God forbid, you do find your, like, holy grail pair of jeans that are perfect, you know, good fabric, good fit, company you don't totally despise, not $900 a pair, then immediately...
Yes, because they're not cool.
Yes, immediately they will discontinue them. Like, are they spying on me? How do they know? How do they know? I don't get it. And then these friends change. Like, I don't even care, but now I can't even buy the kind of pants I like because they're out of fashion. And I don't like it. So there's that.
Yeah, it's expensive, yeah. And then, you know, your body changes again. God forbid.
Just buy like 40 pairs. Refuse to.
Yeah, all different patterns.
If you find the right ones, you should buy a whole pile of them before they can discontinue them. Although that's expensive.
Yeah, I think I might actually just start wearing overalls forever. Okay, now, Laura, what do you have to cuss and discuss?
I would like to cuss the people who plan ag conferences for the springtime, because they should know better. I'm busy. I can't go to Italy right now, although I would love to. Yeah, they should know better. They should plan them for the winter when I'm sitting around in my house drinking hot cocoa and watching Netflix and waiting for something to do. So curse you, conference people.
Yes. For sure. And even if they're going to get, like, plan it for the winter, and if it's an in-person, have a snow day. Like, don't plan it and not have a backup, because then they're going to be annoyed that they ran a thing and then it got canceled or no one showed up because it was lousy weather. Like, think about, you know, if we live in northern climates, it's going to happen this day, and the snow day is the next day or 2 days later or something. Just, like, plan for the things that you know are going to happen. We know that spring is not a good time for conferences, and we know snow happens in the wintertime.
Also, Laura, I'm gonna piggyback on your cussing and discussing. If you want younger people to come to your stuff, and especially women, offer childcare. because what the hell am I supposed to do with my kids? Especially, you know, now they're in school, but when they're little, okay, you know, yeah.
Well, I'd still bring him, but nobody else would like that.
Well, tough nuggies.
Yeah.
Should have had childcare.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, Arlene, what are you cussing and discussing today?
So mine is inspired by our laundry discussions from before. My washing machine had one of those codes that who knows what it means, but it, you know, I looked it up on the internet and it was like it wasn't draining properly. So no problem. We'll try and take it apart. We were successful at the taking it apart step, less successful at the putting it back together step. And as it turns out, it needs a new pump. So anyway, we got the appliance guy after we flooded the laundry room, during one of those steps. And it is shocking the amount of laundry that one of my kids is away, but five of us can create in the week that we have been out without a washing machine. So, cussing the amount of laundry, but also, five stars to my mother-in-law who has been very generously doing some loads of laundry for me. But she has a smaller washing machine than I do. And I think she's overwhelmed as well. So thank you to my mother-in-law, Joanne, who's been doing a lot of laundry in small loads. And my children just keep getting bigger. So, you know, like once your kids are over 6 feet, the laundry, the sizes of the stuff continues to expand too. So hopefully the part will come in soon and I will have a washing machine in my house again. Although it's nice to have stuff come back folded in a basket because I get the stuff clean usually, but folding is not usually one of my top chores. So that has been very nice.
Me neither. I'm in kidding season right now. There is no time for folding. It's going in a pile. It's clean, but it's in a pile.
Yeah. My usual technique is we've got four kids and I have one of those hampers that's on a set of rollers that in the upstairs hallway, and each kid's stuff gets tossed into their basket in that hamper. And if they choose to get dressed out of those baskets, out of unfolded and clean clothes, then that's cool. And if they want to put it away, that's also cool. And when it gets full, it gets dumped on their bed and they have to deal with it. But yeah, otherwise, once it gets to that step, then I'm definitely out. There's no folding going on. So we both want to thank you, Laura, both for being a listener, which is a huge thrill for us to talk to someone who knows our voices and now gets to see our face on Riverside where we're recording. But we also want to thank you for being on the show today and sharing your farm and your family with us. And if people want to look you up online, where can they find you?
We are on Facebook at The Cook Farm. We're not very original when we named this. We just went with our last name. And we're on Instagram at the_cook_farm.
And we'll definitely hook everyone up in the show notes with the links. Yeah, that's right. You don't need to be too creative. Then people can find you.
All right. Thanks again for coming on, Laura.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us on Barnyard Language. If you enjoy the show, please support us on Patreon with a donation.
Big thanks go out to our show editor, Krista Paffrath, at the Rural Podcast Network.
Please rate and review the podcast wherever you listen and follow the show so you never miss an episode.
If you want to connect with other farming families, join the private Barnyard Language Facebook group.
We are always in search of future guests for the podcast. If you or someone you know would like to chat with us, get in touch.